Outliers, a story of success. Author, Malcolm Gladwell. Outliers are men and women who do things that are out of the ordinary. Geniuses, business tycoons, rock stars, or software programmers. The question is it the skills, the talent, or the thing that drives outliers to be so? Most probably, there's something wrong about the way we make sense of success. In the autobiographies published every year by billionaires, entrepreneurs, rock stars, celebrities, the storyline is always the same. Our hero is born in modest circumstances and by virtue of his own grit and talent, fights his way to greatness. Those personal experiences don't work. People don't rise from nothing. We do owe something to parentage and patronage. The people who stand before kings may look like they did it all themselves. But in fact, they're invariably the beneficiaries of hidden advantages and extraordinary opportunities and cultural legacies that allow them to learn and work hard and make sense of the world in ways others cannot. The 10,000-hour rule. For almost a generation, psychologists around the world have been engaged in a spirited debate over a question that most of us would consider to have been settled years ago. The question is this: is there such thing as innate talent? The obvious answer is yes. Not every hockey player born in January ends up playing at the professional level. Only some do. The innately talented ones. Achievement is talent plus preparation. The problem with this view is that the closer psychologists look at the careers of the gifted, the smaller the role innate talent seems to play and the bigger the role of preparation seems to play. Opportunity. If we put all the possible success stories together, we get a more complete picture of the path to success. Successful people are surely and undeniably talented, but what truly distinguishes their histories is not their extraordinary talents, but their extraordinary opportunities. Bill Gates, for instance, said at the beginning of an interview that he was very lucky to have a computer lab in his school in mid-60s. That doesn't mean he isn't brilliant or an extraordinary entrepreneur. It just means that he understands what incredible good fortune it was to be at Lakeside School in 1968. Most of the outliers were in the beneficiaries of some kind of unusual opportunity. Lucky breaks don't seem like an exception with software billionaires and rock bands and star athletes. They seem like the rule. The trouble with geniuses. Over the years, an enormous amount of research has been done in an attempt to determine how a person's performance on an IQ test like to life success. People at the bottom of the scale, with an IQ below 70, are considered to be mentally disabled. A score of 100 is average. You probably need to be just above that mark to be able to handle college. To get into and succeed in reasonably competitive graduate programs, you probably need an IQ of at least 115. In general, the higher your score is, the more education you'll get, the more money you'll be likely to make, and believe it or not, the longer you'll live. But here's the catch. The relationship between success and IQ works only up to a point. Once someone has reached an IQ of somewhere around 120, having additional IQ points doesn't seem to translate into any measurable real-world advantage. But the relation seems to break down when one is making comparisons between two people, both of whom will have IQs which are relatively high. A mature scientist with an adult IQ of 130 is as likely to win a Nobel Prize as one whose IQ is 180. If intelligence matters only up to a point, then past that point, other things, that have nothing to do with intelligence, must start to matter more. It's like basketball again. Once someone is tall enough, then we start to care about speed, and court sense, and agility, and ball handling skills, and shooting touch. So what might some of those things be? Well, suppose that instead of measuring your IQ, I have you take a totally different kind of test, as follows. Write down as many different uses that you can think of for the following objects. 1. A brick. 2. A blanket. Here, for example, are answers to the uses of objects. Test collected by Liam Hudson from a student named Poole at a top British high school. To use in smash and grab raids. To help hold a house together. To use in a game of Russian roulette if you want to keep fit at the same time. Bricks at 10 paces, turn and throw. No evasive action allowed. To hold the aider down on a bed, tow a brick at each corner. As a breaker of empty Coca-Cola bottles. Blanket. To use on bed, as a tent. To make smoke signals with. As a sail for a boat, cart, or sled. As a substitute for a towel. As a target for shooting practice. For short-sighted people. As a thing to catch people jumping out of burning skyscrapers. It's not hard to read Poole's answers and get some sense of how his mind works. He's funny, he's a little subversive, and libidinous. He has the flair from the dramatic. His mind leaps from violent imagery to people jumping out of burning skyscrapers to very practical issues, such as how to get a duvet to stay on a bed. He gives us the impression that if we give him another 10 minutes, he'd come up with another 20 uses. Now, for the sake of comparison, consider the answers of another student from Hudson's sample. His name is Florence. Hudson tells us that Florence is a prodigy, with one of the highest IQ in his school. Brick. Building things. Throwing. Blanket. Keeping warm. Smothering fire. Where's Florence's imagination? He identified the most common and functional uses for bricks and blankets and simply stopped. Florence's IQ is higher than Poole's, but that means little, since both students are above the threshold. What is more interesting is that Poole's mind can leap from topic to another without missing a beat, and Florence's mind can't. Now, which of these two students do you think is better suited to do the kind of brilliant, imaginative work that wins Nobel Prizes? This exactly was Terman's error. He fell in love with the fact that his termites were at the absolute pinnacle of intellectual skill, without realizing how little that seemingly extraordinary fact meant. By the time the termites reached adulthood, Terman's error was plain to see. Some of his child geniuses had grown up to publish books and scholarly articles and thrive in business. Several ran for public office, and there were two superior court justices, one municipal court judge, two members of the California state legislature, and one prominent state official. But few of his geniuses were nationally known figures. They tended to earn good incomes, but not that good. The majority had careers that could only be considered ordinary, and a surprising number ended up with careers that even Terman considered failures. Not were there any Nobel Prize winners in his exhaustively selected group of geniuses. His field workers actually tested two elementary students who went on to be Nobel laureates, William Shockley and Luis Alvarez, and rejected them both. Their IQs weren't high enough. In a devastating critique, the sociologist Pitram Sorokin once showed that if Terman had simply put together a randomly selected group of children from the same kinds of family backgrounds as the termites and dispensed with IQs altogether, he would have ended up with a group doing almost as many impressive things as his painstakingly selected group of geniuses. By no stretch of the imagination or of standards of genius, Sorokin concluded, is the gifted group as a whole gifted. By the time Terman came out with his fourth volume of Genetic Studies of Genius, the word genius had all but vanished. We have seen, Terman concluded, with more than a touch of disappointment, that intellect and achievement are far from perfectly correlated.